Hello, friends. I'm Matt Baum. The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Big thanks to all the listeners who make the show possible, and if you're enjoying the show, join us by going to sewersofparis.com and clicking Support the Show on Patreon. And now, we're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest, H. Alan Scott, says...
I went through that year of chemo, and then I decided to just not go back to work.
The topic is Bette Midler, The Birdcage, and In-N-Out. My guest this week is writer and comedian H. Alan Scott, whom you may know as co-host of the fabulous Out on the Lanai podcast. But he first came to my attention when I was working as a nightlife photographer in Los Angeles. There was this one guy I'd photograph at a bar every now and then who was shy, who hung back from the dance floor, and who, whenever I took his picture, would have something to say that made me laugh. And that man was Howie Mandel. Just kidding, it was H. Alan Scott. I never told him this, but I didn't just look forward to photographing him because he was funny and friendly. H. Alan was a pleasure to shoot because he'd never posed. It may not come as a total surprise that in Los Angeles, many people are very concerned with how they are seen. And so whenever a camera is nearby, they contort themselves into an improbable shape that they believe is the most flattering, and as a result, pictures of them are more often about their posture than the person. H. Alan, on the other hand, always looked into my camera honestly, sometimes with a smile and sometimes not. I didn't know it, but at the time, he was emerging from a long and difficult ordeal that had changed his life. And when I pointed my camera at him, I was pointing it at a man who had no use for putting on a happy face. Hello, welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm Matt Baum, and I'm talking today to writer-comedian H. Alan Scott. You may know him from the fabulous Golden Girls podcast Out on the Lanai. You might have seen him on MTV, through Vice, or Fusion. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
If I had to pick like one person that probably influenced me the most as a kid, it would be Bette Midler. Everything about her.
Can you believe Bette Midler? I don't think she's come up more than like two or three times on this podcast, like in the year that I've been doing this.
Yeah, that surprises me. I mean, especially considering that it's probably mostly, you know, gay or gay adjacent people. Like it's right.
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
I was having a conversation with somebody a while back, and he was like, oh, I really like his drag queen. And he's like, I like to do the classic stuff. And I'm like, oh, we're going to talk about Bette Midler. And he's like early Lady Gaga. And I'm like,
what? No, that's not classic. There's nothing classic about that.
Stop it.
That's classic for like the aughts.
I know. Well, these kids today. So tell me all about Bette Midler for people who are shamefully unfamiliar.
Okay. Bette Midler is a actress, singer, entertainer. Yeah, I mean, Broadway performer. She got her start on Broadway and then sort of worked her way into nightclubs and the gay bathhouses of New York City as a songstress, sort of entertainer, sort of cabaret-esque.
I'm doing this whole thing on sheer nerve. Honey, I ain't been to sleep in 3 days. And I, your mother is very tired. Your mother is not a well woman. Are any of us, I ask you. Okay.
I mean, I suppose it was cabaret. I mean, it was sexual and it was body and it was sort of mixed a bit between vaudeville and in a weird way, she was kind of like the 1970s version of Fanny Bryce, like Fanny Bryce being funny girl, iconic Bette Midler movie. And then the actual woman who was Fanny Bryce, who was like this Jewish sort of vaudeville songstress that was really funny. And she was a comedian and she was really good on the radio. But once everything went towards film, she clearly looked like a Jew, and so nobody wanted that in the 1930s, so she didn't have a career.
The tinkle of a music box is music to my ear. I'm delicate and fragile, like a crystal chandelier. Though I'm a perfect picture in mine lavender and lace, my quaintiness and daintiness, it's getting me no place.
And Bette Midler kind of was that in many respects for, I think, the entertainment scene in New York, the live entertainment scene in New York at the time, because she was this sort of like fat-faced, sort of Jewy-looking Hawaiian woman with like really frizzy hair who did not have a place in terms of, you know, she wasn't the conventional beauty, so she couldn't do the leading roles. And she wasn't, her voice wasn't like, even though her voice is beautiful, and if you listen to her early records, it's like surprising the range that she has. But Her voice was very sort of loud and in your face. And so, I mean, she never really was perfect at anything, but she was great at everything.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of the appeal is just down to her incredible charisma.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she had such energy. I mean, if you go on YouTube, which I guess when you post this podcast, you should definitely post some of her cabaret performances, because they're up on YouTube, the Bathhouse performances. So she wasn't getting time, like, in the regular circuit of live performances. So she went wherever she could to perform. And one of the places that accepted her was the gay bathhouses of New York in the late 60s, early 70s, with her pianist came along with her, early Barry Manilow, totally not gay, totally kind of gay. And he's never come out, which is the weirdest thing to me. But he, so they would go to these bathhouses, and the men in these baths, you'd see men hanging around in like towels and shit. And then she would just be performing and making jokes, and she would look sort of strange, and she'd have like, I remember one outfit she had, like it went around her neck and it like side boob for days, and it was just so low cut in the back, and it basically was just like fabric covering her tits. And she was so bawdy, and so she created this sort of like attention. She got this attention for being sort of a rebel in a way as a performer, and performing for these men that, again, it coincided historically with Stonewall. So it was very, this is when she was performing. She was on Fiddler on the Roof, and then she was doing all these cabaret acts and these bathhouse acts.
Dear Yanta, see that he's gentle. Remember, you were also a bride.
It's not that I'm sentimental. It's just that I'm terrible.
And then in the early 70s, you know, she started getting more and more attention and got a record deal, and she kind of blew up. And now we have Bette Midler. Well, at least that was the early stage of Bette Midler. So that's the Bette Midler nobody knows about. Like, the kids, the little gay kids, they know Bette Midler probably from... Actually, I met a gay kid who, like, recently, this young comic, such a little schmuck, who didn't know First Wives Club. Like, he wasn't aware of First Wives Club. And that's, yes, granted, it's been 20 years since First Wives Club came out, which is sort of shocking to me because I saw it in theaters. But it's... And I'm not that old, I'm 33. But still...
And don't tell me what to do, and don't tell me what to say, and when I go out with you, don't put me on display.
Pretty good.
You remember. You don't own me.
It's 20 years, but he didn't know what First Wives Club is. But kids probably know her from First Wives Club, or their parents liking Wind Beneath My Wings or something. I don't know. But that was her first sort of stage of her career, was this rock sort of ballad-driven, unique performer that put on these shows that were sort of part stand-up comedy, part singing, part play. I mean, it was very strange. It was definitely a Vegas act on the road for a new generation of people.
There's something kind of insane about the idea of like going to a bathhouse and having like a female cabaret performance happening in the midst of all the like just lounging and sweating. And one would assume lots and lots of sex, and that just having her in the middle of all that.
I mean, if you think about it, like, again, historical context, the bathhouses now are sort of a thing. I mean, they're slowly coming back, but when the AIDS epidemic hit, they were closed. They were banned. I mean, cities would close them down because they thought that they were sort of what ushered in HIV, AIDS to the community, which isn't necessarily true. But yeah, so she was performing at these gay bathhouses. I mean, if you look in the long sort of gay icons, you know, like, I mean, people like to make fun of like Barbara Streisand being a gay icon, or like Liza Minnelli, or even Bea Arthur, as going back to the Golden Girls. Like, there's a reason why these women are gay icons. It's because Judy Garland being another one, it's like each one of them is a little bit ugly. You know what I mean? There's something about is not conventionally like the norm in terms of what a woman entertainer is supposed to be. But they go beyond that, and they even use what makes them quote unquote ugly to be beautiful. And so that's basically being gay. It's like, you know, especially back in the day, it's like, you know, you're weird, you're an outcast, you're a sexual minority, you're what are you? You're just strange. But if you can be fabulous, you literally yourself. We want your 100% pure self. And that's what these women represented, and that's what Bette Midler represented, I think.
Is that what she represented to you when you discovered her?
No, not at all. The gay thing wasn't there, even though maybe I think subconsciously it was when I discovered her. So, like, the second stage of her career was filmmaking. We went from being a musical performer to being sort of this live performer that put on these shows. There's a great album of hers called Live at Last. It came out a year before her first film, and it's an amazing album. I highly recommend it because it really shows Bette Midler before she became the movie actress that we know her now, probably more popularly.
I was in the woods last night with my boyfriend Ernie, and he said to me, Soph, he always called me Soph. He said to me, Soph, these woods sure are dark. I sure wish I had a flashlight. I said to him, so do I, Ernie. You have been munching grass for the last 10 minutes.
It's just an amazing album, and it mixes comedy, and I listen to it a lot of times before I do stand-up sets because it just gets me in the mood. But when I discovered her, it was through film. And I remember as a kid, I forget where we'd vacation. It was somewhere ridiculous in Missouri, probably near a lake somewhere where, like, no one should really vacation there. But because we were so landlocked, we were just like, well, there's water. Let's hang out here. And there was this movie sort of screening room at the lake resort that we were at that would show Big Business. And I remember Big Business is a 1988 film with Lily Tomlin and Bette Midler, where they play twins who are born, but two sets of twins. So Lily Tomlin and Bette Midler, it's hard to even describe it. Lily Tomlin and Bette Midler play two different roles. There's the country ho-dunk version of them and their twin sisters that are so, like, they're not fraternal. Is that one of the ones that look alike? Fraternal? Yeah, they're not fraternal. So that's why they look so different, but they're twins. And then there's another one, sort of like an uber successful New York socialite with her, like, secretary sister twin, who Lily Tomlin's the lowly one. And then they go to the big city and, oh my God, we look alike. And it's like comedy of errors. It's ridiculous. And it's not a good movie. Like, now looking back at it as an adult human male, I definitely am a little like, this is kind of shit. But at the time when I was 6 years old, I loved it. And I loved how over the top it was. And I was just obsessed with this woman who had this, like, massive mane of hair that just, like, just red hair that just was so over the top. And she was ugly. Like, they both were ugly. Like, they were not, like, not ugly in the sense of, like, gag, I want to die, but, like, ugly in the sense of, like, they weren't like other women I saw.
They weren't, like, Olivia Newton-John.
No, they weren't Olivia Newton-John. They weren't Michelle Pfeiffer, who was, like, really popular. And they weren't these, like, I'm going to the movies and I'm seeing these women in movies and they're all, like, blonde and beautiful and skinny and whatever, like Sigourney Weaver, tall, whatever. Melanie Griffith, Working Girl, like, all these movies. And they're all pretty women, you know, and the ugly ones are, like, smaller roles. Like, they're the Joan Cusack role in Working Girl. It's, like, the roles that matter, that you remember, but, like, no one kisses them kind of roles. And here are two women who, and conversely, I also fell in love with Lily Tomlin at that point, too. Let me just say that right now. But the Bette Midler took a hold because her career was sort of more over the top at the time. And I remember just loving how there's these two kind of ugly-ish women who were so weird and they were in charge. It was the whole film. The whole film was these two women, weird-looking women doing weird shit. And it's all about them. And I just thought, how cool is that? That, like, I'm responding to these two people. I don't know why, but probably now I know why. And I just loved it. I loved it. So I became obsessed and I started watching her. Shortly after that, as a kid, I loved Johnny Carson. I was, like, obsessed with Johnny Carson. And oftentimes I would watch Johnny Carson and then reenact his monologue the next day at school. And the kids would be like, you know, why are you talking about this woman named Brooke Shields or something? Like, whatever. Like, whoever he was talking about. And I would talk about these celebrities not knowing who they were just because I was trying to do Johnny Carson's jokes. And Bette Midler had gone on the Johnny. She was a frequent guest on Carson. But I had first seen her, I think, in, like, an 88 or 89, shortly after Big Business. And I was like, here's the woman I'm obsessed with. And she was so funny on it, like, as a human, like, as a normal person.
Oh, Mr. Carson.
Oh, Miss Midler, how are you?
You like my outfit?
I think it's... Yes, well, yes, I do.
Oh,
That's a fashion statement.
Thank you. Yeah. I was the last one out of Fredericks of Hollywood before they torched us. Can I ask you, now who would set fire to a bunch of brassieres, dear?
Aww. I just became obsessed with her, so I got all the albums, and I watched all the movies, and it just was a spiral of just, like, Bette Midler.
I really love two things about that. One is just the image of you as a little kid doing Johnny Carson routines at school.
Yeah.
And being like a tough room because the kids don't get any of the jokes.
No one. Everyone thought I was just this annoying little kid.
And then, like, the little, like, elementary school Bette Midler devotee. It's like, were you, like, collecting her stuff? And, like, did you have anyone that you could share that passion with?
Well, my parents were divorced, and I had no contemporary that I could share that passion with. But that's the same for every gay kid, basically. Like, any gay kid from a small town who isn't living in an urban city. Like, the chances of there being another gay kid that's similar to you in that school is slim. I'm grateful that my parents were always very sort of, like, accepting of me having interests in the weirdest shit and sort of letting me go with it. But my parents sort of, like, they kind of relished. I mean, they gave up on trying to get me to play sports and things, and I would just sort of do my own thing. And I was never, like, a show tunes kid. I was never that person. I was always, like, I liked the weird shit. You know, I liked, like, Golden Girls, and then I would become obsessed with, like, researching BR. And then I became obsessed with Diane Keaton, and I did like a 10-page report on her in seventh grade, like, ridiculous. So my parents definitely relished in me being that weird kid who, like, became obsessed with these other things. And the only contemporary that I probably had that I could sort of share this with was, like, my alcoholic stepmother, who she also just sort of relished celebrity culture and liked it and everything. And she wasn't very smart, so I'd always, like, correct her on, like, historical facts about celebrities.
She must have loved that.
Yeah, no, she was a drunk. She needed to go. And she went in 1993. Not dead. She's probably dead now, though. But at the time, she wasn't dead. She was just gone. And she... that's horrible of me to laugh at. She would take me to Madonna concerts and Janet Jackson concerts. And here I am, this six-year-old kid going to... No, at the time, eight-year-old kid going to Blonde Ambition Tour, which I should not have gone to, like, at all. But she loved it, and she loved that I gave her an excuse to, like, take her gay friend as well to, like, Blonde Ambition Tour, and they would just get shit-faced drunk, and then I would have to call Dad to be like, come pick us up. But I didn't care, because I got to see Madonna. She sort of encouraged this buying of all the albums, watching all the movies, knowing as much about Bette Midler as possible. And I did. And then it's sort of after that, I mean, from Big Business, if you think of Bette Midler's career, from Big Business until the early 90s, there was a lot happening for Bette Midler. I mean, she had two of her biggest singles, Wind Beneath My Wings, and I forget the other song, whatever. She had two big songs. And she had Beaches come out, and then she had For the Boys come out, so it was her second Oscar nomination. So it was like, boom, 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 Bette Midler is in my life. And here I am, being this 8, 9, 10-year-old kid, obsessed with Bette Midler. And I'm trying to, like, do jokes like she does. And at the time, I also kind of became obsessed with Sabra Bernhardt, so I was, like, combining those two, which is a weird combination. And, like... And then I discovered Rosie O'Donnell, and it was just sort of, and Rosie O'Donnell was obsessed with Bette Midler, so it, like, worked really well. And so all of these things spoke to each other, and it was these pivotal years where, like, these ugly, funny women in my life were, like, influencing me on so many levels that, that I just couldn't escape them, and I just sort of embraced it and just let it be sort of the foundation of my humor, which... There's a reason why I sound like a, especially in my stand-up act, I sound very much like a Jewy mother, because I'm yelling and screaming like Bette Midler or Barbara Streisand would, or, you know, these women that I imitated so much, or at least, I take that back, I didn't imitate them, like their sort of cadence, I imitated their delivery. So, like, the way Bette Midler delivered jokes, the way Bea Arthur delivered jokes, I would try to emulate that when I would tell jokes at school and was trying to be funny, and I would tell stories, and I would gesticulate in ways that, like, I would watch them do, and everyone would be like, they would notice it as a unique funny thing because I was combining all of these different women into one person, me. Yeah, I can't think of one man that influenced me.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, my dad wasn't around a lot, and... I can say that the only man probably that influenced me before that was Robin Williams. And once Birdcage came, I was just like, yeah, Robin Williams, you got it.
Was there? Well, I was going to ask if there was a particular role that really spoke to you, but it sounds like that's the one.
Well, there was a lot. I mean, I always loved Robin Williams' sort of like heart. Like, there was so much heart in his humor, and I found that to be sort of irresistible in a way. I always felt that like you could always kind of be nice even when you're angry, sort of thing. And Robin Williams was always kind of that way. And he was so sensitive, too. And I'm so glad I was so fortunate enough to have met him before he passed away. He just, it's so sad. But I saw The Birdcage, and The Birdcage was sort of also a pivotal, I mean, 1996 was a pivotal year in terms of Bette Midler, but also in terms of my life, because I'm 14, and my so-called life had just gone off the air, and I was sort of understanding the sadness of, like, missing Ricky in my life, and there was no other gay character sort of around, really, at the time that was, like, doing anything, and I was going through puberty, and I was, you know, understanding more and more about myself. And I didn't come from, like, an oppressed home or anything. So, like, being gay was never a weird, weird thing for me. But I always knew it was also kind of, like, culturally not a good thing. And 1996, I saw The Birdcage in the summer, I think it came out. I remember seeing it with my family, and my family thought it was hilarious. And that was such a huge thing for me. And then also seeing Nathan Lane and Robin Williams in that film and sort of creating a character that wasn't a caricature, but it was using elements of caricature to create this sort of really emotional character. And I loved that. I loved the idea of, I mean, at the time I didn't recognize it as intellectually as I do now, but I remember thinking, like, I love that they made this sort of Nathan Lane sissy gay man into an emotional person. They gave him a soul, you know, and that sort of taught me that, like, you can be any gay way you want to be. You don't have to be Queenie. You don't have to be anything. And you can still be gay and tell a joke and have it deliver hard. And you can use elements of whatever stereotype people are throwing at you and use it to make fun of other people, which is sort of great.
Stop the doctors. You'll stop the abortions.
Well, that's ridiculous. The doctors are only doing their jobs. If you're going to kill someone, kill the mothers. That'll stop them.
May I see you for a moment, dear?
Oh, I know what you're going to say. If you kill the mother, the fetus dies too. But the fetus is going to be aborted anyway, so why not let it go down with the ship?
So that happened, and then First Wives Club came out, and it was just like, boom, Bette Midler all over again. And she was back in it, and there were so many great things happening with Bette Midler. And here I am, a teenager, understanding that I am funny, and I want to be funny, and I want to perform, and I want to do these things. And I'm seeing all these things. And it was a good year. 1996 was a good year.
Something you mentioned about The Birdcage was that it showed you that you could take the stereotypes that people are throwing at you and turn them around and use them to make fun of someone else. Were there people throwing stereotypes at you, or did you feel like you were searching for what is gay?
I think any minority group, no matter who you are, if you are a faction that has a cultural misrepresentation, so, like, for example, you know, you have African American, and then immediately someone goes into, like, a sassy black woman talk, or they turn into they culturally appropriate certain things on you because of the minority that you are. And oftentimes minorities adopt those stereotypes because they find strength in them. So, like, you know, for example, the African American community using the N-word, and you have African Americans using it back and forth with each other, it's an adoption of strength, taking something negative and turning it into something that can be a positive. And the same for, even now, you see, I chat with a lot of my friends a lot of times, close friends, about how upset I am about how backwards we go, I think, oftentimes in terms of gay comedy, and how we're often pandering to the lowest common denominator. An example of this is, and this isn't, like, sponsored by Logo or anything, right? This
nope.
Podcast? Okay, good.
Talk shit.
Good. Logo. Who, I will say, Logo, you have an important presence in the lexicon of entertainment, and they have produced some great stuff before, but, like, things like the gay skit show that's coming out on Logo. There's one, they produced a short about what gays do during the Super Bowl or something, and it's three performers. I don't know their names, but I know of them, and I've judged all of them. And they're doing everything that is not only, like, stereotypically gay in a way, like gardening, like whatever, on grind, stupid shit. And in slow motion. And it's basically saying that gay people can enjoy the Super Bowl game. So we're going to use a stereotype to illustrate why, in a stereotypical way, gay people typically don't adopt sort of sport culture. Like, we aren't a part. And it's true. I don't like sports. I've never watched a football game in my life. Like, I don't, I go to Super Bowl parties to eat. Like, I don't like go to watch the game, and I've never watched a game in my life. I think the only game I ever watched was when the Saints won the Super Bowl, and that was because I was on a date and I had to because I didn't impress them. But it's not like I'm going to go into a Super Bowl party and start lambasting everyone with why I'm gay and I don't like this. And because my being gay has nothing to do with me not liking it. And so having gay comedy and having a network that has influence, which I think, like, the more exposure the gay community has and the more money that's thrown at the gay community in terms of creating content, the more responsibility the gay community has in terms of producing content that is genuine to who we are. And I'm sorry, like, gardening during a Super Bowl game is not genuine to who we are. Like, that's not something that I want to create and tell people. You know what I mean? I want to tell people that, like, just like straight people, I go on dates with people with bad breath. And, like, I try to avoid that bad breath. Like, that's a common thing that we all deal with. That's a skit that I wrote recently. Anyway, I think it's good to adopt stereotypes. I think it's beneficial to adopt stereotypes. And I like that the Birdcage did that. I think it's great when other people do. Because you can use it to prove a point. You can use it to prove a greater point about how either silly a stereotype is or how, you know, there's a reason why we adopt stereotypes. Like, I'm sure there's a reason why I gravitated towards the women that I did in my life, like Bette Midler. I mean, because she does have a gay following, and I'm sure subconsciously I was aware of that somewhere in the words that I've read over my life, and it's influenced me, and I take strength in it because, you know, it's a part of who I am. That said, it's not because I'm gay. It's because I am influenced by the things in my life, and my interest in Bette Midler has nothing to do with me being gay. I'm sure there is a straight man out there that enjoys Bette Midler at some point.
Sure, let's say, and it's not like, you know, to bring up another movie that revels in stereotypes, Kevin Kline and In-N-Out,
yeah.
You know, where it's like, oh, okay, well, he likes Cher and he likes Funny Girl, yeah. And mm-hmm.
I think, though, with that, with your reference of In-N-Out, which I think is an appropriate reference, I think it's also important to remember the historical context in which, you know, these things happened. Like, for example, In-N-Out, 1998. It was a couple of months after Ellen came out. Like, it was, gay marriage was not a thing. Matthew Shepard still wasn't killed yet, I don't think. Like, gay acceptance was not necessarily, you know, something that was on the people's forefront. And I think in some respects, even though I do feel like In-N-Out does pander from my 2016 eyes, I think my 1998 eyes, it probably was beneficial. I mean, think about it. It was a mainstream film that starred, yes, mostly straight people, but it got straight people to accept a gay storyline, even though that storyline was pandering at a time when straight people weren't recognizing gay people because everyone was in the closet. So on another level, I think maybe In-N-Out did something good. I think those films that did pander, because they were using a stereotype in order to get greater understanding of an issue, which that issue was accepting who you are and being out and telling the people you love in your life that this is who you are and that's fine. Now that would be different. And that's the thing. That's the exact point, is that, like, this gay skit show that's coming out, from the stuff that I've seen, and some of the other things that I see online, a lot of these web series, I think that they're creating content based that's being informed by 1998 storytelling, but they need to be doing 2016 storytelling, where we live in a post-gay world where, especially if you're in an urban city, it's different in smaller cities, but if you're in an urban setting, the chances of you being discriminated against is very slim.
I hear what you're saying. You know, it makes me think of how, for me, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert was a very important movie when I was a teenager. And at this point in my life, I think I've heard enough jokes about ABBA and gays that I'm like, all right, I'm good. I'm good on ABBA gay jokes.
Yeah, totally. But again, like, you got to give credit to the drag queens for being the original people to usher in acceptance of gay lifestyle. Like, if it weren't for drag queens, I don't think the gay rights movement would have moved in a way that it did, or would have gained greater acceptance.
When you were just coming out and figuring out what gay is, it sounds like you were fortunate enough to have like a pretty supportive environment. But did you have any concerns? Because maybe this wasn't the plan at the time, but at some point you got into comedy. And did you have any concerns that being gay and being in comedy would be in conflict in some way?
I didn't know that. And I was just telling a friend last night that it would be a lot easier if I were straight or not out. Like, how do I say this? Being a gay comic, which I don't like saying that, but being a comic that is gay, you sort of struggle between, there's two avenues I can go. I can focus on doing all the gay rooms and do an entirely gay set and only perform to gay people and the women that go with them. And only having one niche market and make a career out of it. And there are many friends of mine, gay comics, that do that. That, you know, they are one track mind, and that's fine. But I think because of my upbringing and because of the very open and accepting home that I came from, I've never identified telling a joke from a gay perspective. I've always identified telling a joke from a joke's perspective. And then if it happens to be about a date with a man, that is just a date with a man. It's not a gay date. And so, for example, like now dealing with the industry, I'm working on a web series. Unfortunately, I do have support from other people. But, you know, when I was pitching it around and as we worked through stuff, there was a lot of feedback from people being like, you know, that they've met sort of the quota for the year of their gay content, or that they've said it in a way. They never would say that, but they would mention like, well, we're working with this person and this person and this person, all gay guys. And so I think we're going to pass on this. Basically them saying, we have these three gay people and I don't think we could have another gay person. And so they would put that on you, and then me as the person, as the creator, respond with, well, I never called this gay content. I never considered this gay content. The web series is about sort of dating in Los Angeles. It's largely based on my stand-up set. And yeah, I happen to be going on dates with men, but like, they're not all gay-centric. There are some that are very specific to the gay community, but I think that are important. Like, there's this one that I we're producing where I hook up with a person who's HIV positive because out of liberal guilt, like when he tells me on the date that he's HIV positive, and there's a voiceover of me saying like, well, now I have to sleep with you. And just as like a liberal crusade. And then I do. And then at the end of the date, I learn that the only reason he slept with me is because he wanted to sleep with an average guy. Like, he was like a really hot, ripped guy. So it's sort of proving that like, we're all assholes. even people who are HIV positive are assholes. We're all assholes. And we're human, and we're the same, and we think the same, and everything's normal. And so that's the only sort of gay-specific script that I sent in. Everything else is just dating. It's just life. It's just sex. I never thought that I would get this much pushback, especially in 2016, from just trying to present a script that showed human beings. So it is rough. It's not easy. They definitely want to... I remember before I got cancer, I'm fine now, but before I got cancer and I would try to get submitted to write for different places or to do certain things, or I would do shows and I would ask them to list the show or whatever, they would always put me in the gay section, or they would always push me to something gay. It was always gay just because I was gay or I am gay. But even if it had nothing to do with being gay, I would just always be in that gay world and I couldn't get out of it. And I think in a weird way, fortunately for cancer, it sort of made me more universal. But it's also shitty that like the fact now that because I got a little bit of acclaim for like writing about cancer, now it's okay to put me in another area because now normal people, quote unquote, are going to be able to understand my work and read my work and like accept it, because everyone can accept cancer. And it's like, fuck you. It's really annoying. But I will admit, just in like all candor, that like it is really, really, really frustrating to see stuff like the gay skit show out there and the pandering content. And I never once think I'm better than anybody else. Of course, that's not where I go. That's not where my brain goes. There is, of course, there's an artistic jealousy that happens, and that's natural. But my brain goes to, what good does this do? This isn't funny. In fact, it's offensive. And what is this doing? Like, what is this showing to a 12-year-old kid in Missouri who is gay, and he's living in a gay world now that he knows he can get married, which I never thought I could. And he knows that, you know, he maybe won't get HIV and that's going to be fine. He's going to be able to afford, like, what does it do So that funny gay kid who probably likes Lady Gaga or something and who wants to grow up and be funny, and yet he's seeing someone doing something that just is backwards, that doesn't make sense, like gardening instead of being at a Super Bowl party. Fuck you!
There have been times where, like, I've either misunderstood, like, I'm thinking back to, like, when I was a kid, and, like, my idea of what a gay bar was informed by this, like, hodgepodge of different stereotypes that had come at me from the popular culture of the mid-90s. And so, for some reason, I'd gotten it into my head, probably because, like, all of my depictions of gays were from, like, the fancy characters on sitcoms on Nick at Night, you know, where it was all it was all euphemistic, that I just thought gay bars would be, like, brightly lit and everyone's in a sweater and they're all like there's curtains everywhere and you know it's all like
totally.
I had this idea that gay bars were like bright lit and there's floral arrangements everywhere and so like when I went to my first gay bar I was so woefully unprepared for what was awaiting me. Like in my head I kind of invented sweater bars and fern bars by accident.
No, I had no clue. I don't remember my first gay bar, to be honest. It was definitely in St. Louis. And considering that it's St. Louis, it definitely was very laid back and probably had a tremendous amount of people with, like, average-size waistlines, which was welcoming. But I remember being intimidated, but only because I'm, like, naturally intimidated by, like, everybody around me. I have a social anxiety thing. So I don't think that was a gay thing. Yeah, I never felt the intimidation from the gay community or felt, like, out of touch. No, I never really felt out of touch with the gay bar culture or the gay people around me. It was always, like, I didn't understand why someone wouldn't get me. To me, it was always surprising that, like, you know, if I'm telling these jokes or if I'm in this gay bar and saying these things, like, why am I an outcast just because I'm not buying into this culture of whatever you're telling me to buy into, when, like, I thought this was a culture where we could all be ourselves and just like our own things and actually be honest and open and unique. Like, isn't that what it's all about?
Yeah. Well, it's what you're saying about drag queens, about, like, expressing themselves and being very honest. There's a freedom that came along with being such complete outcasts.
I totally agree with that. There is, and I think it's fascinating, that, like, the more we become accepted as a whole in mainstream culture, the less individualistic we become. And because of that, I think we're struggling to find identities. So, like, now you find the entire culture is, like, so sexualized and so focused on, like, things that I don't even understand. Like, I saw there was some, like, Gaily Grind article or something someone posted about the best Instagram accounts, and they were all were people with, like, taking their shirts off and stuff, and taking, and they're all just, like, pictures of muscles, which I get it. Like, muscles are lovely, they're great, whatever. But, like, is that really what a media outlet is putting out there? Like, how about you put out a thing about, like, oh, the best Instagram accounts, and you list, like, 20 different Instagram accounts that are helping, you know, different gay charities. But that said, like, you know, just like I was when I was a kid, loving Bette Midler and telling the jokes at school, Johnny Carson jokes, and having no kid understand me or understand what the fuck I was doing, I kind of take comfort in being that person that is sort of, like, continually doing the thing that maybe others don't understand or maybe others aren't on board with. And it might mean that I have a very mediocre career, which sucks, but, like, whenever I feel like I'm pandering, whenever I feel like I'm doing something that doesn't feel like me, I think it shows in the work, and I definitely think it shows in the work, and I also think that, like, I'm kind of incapable of doing it.
Was there a point, you mentioned, like, being that kid who's telling the Johnny Carson jokes that nobody gets, was there a point at which you were like, I don't know, that you figured out a little bit better, like, how to make people laugh in a way that spoke to them?
Yeah, I definitely think that. Like, I was always, like, I was a fat kid as a kid. So I was always, like, the funny fat kid. Funny, fat, like, queenie kid. I definitely really early learned sort of, like, I can make people laugh. And it felt good to make people laugh. And it felt good to do something. But also it was a protection thing, too. Like, I've always kind of had a, even though I don't come off as a person who has social anxiety, it's usually because I've taken two Ativan to be at that place. But I've always been very sort of, like, standoffish when it comes to emotional communication, at least in person. And so I tend to, like, put up a wall as a kid. And so I would use comedy and funny and humor and silly stuff as a means of just being like, don't talk to me about my problems. And I've since learned how to healthfully address my problems and live a life that is somewhat good. And I also think being gay and being that outsider and making straight people laugh helped me understand how to construct a joke and how to communicate in a way that I see it now, like during the whole election season stuff, I see like people communicating back and forth between like Bernie and Hillary people or whatever. They get very angry. It's very vicious. Like there's a lot of back and forth and people result to like catty sort of like low blow conversations. Like it's very weird, the language that's being used. And I really do think that it stems from a place where the majority of people out there don't know how to communicate what they're feeling or communicate what they're wanting to say. And like I, as a kid, in order to be funny, had to know how to construct words to be funny and to tell a story and to know when to get that beat at that point. And as a writer, as I got older, like you take that material and you take that persona and I turned it into my writing to kind of put a little bit of me and that voice into my writing. And so I know how to write and I know how to communicate. I know how to put a sentence together that people will be able to read in a nice way and it flows. But I don't think a lot of people do. And I think because of that, subconsciously, they're fighting to be able to express what they're trying to express. And because they can't vocally do it, which they probably would be able to in person, on Facebook, they turn to being like, well, you're a fuckhead. And it's because they don't know how to express their feelings.
And you learned at an early age how to turn you're a fuckhead into something that makes them laugh.
Exactly. Yeah, totally.
What were your, like, were you performing? Like, did you do, like, comedy stuff when you were young?
Yeah, I started, so when I was a kid, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and I graduated high school with Nikki Glaser, who's like a sort of well-known comic now. We're still friends, even though she's way more famous. We both kind of started in St. Louis. She went to college in Kansas and started doing other stuff. And I started like some weird urban clubs downtown because there was no like main comedy club that was going to allow this like sissy little gay boy up on a stage in the suburbs. So I would go down to like Cedric the Entertainer's rooms in downtown St. Louis and perform there just because I guess the black crowds really loved seeing this white boy make a fool of himself. And I loved it. I thought it was great. And then I went to Chicago and I went to school and I would do stand up here and there, but I was mainly focusing on school and I worked in politics for a little while. And then I just kept performing. And
what was your material like?
Back then, it was all really bad shit. It was like, I don't even remember. I'm trying to remember an early joke. I remember I had a joke. I had a very gay joke because I was still trying to find my like my voice and how to tell jokes and not so much how to tell jokes, but I was trying to find how to like put a set together that was real and talked about things. Because when I was a kid, I would always just go for the funny joke. Like it didn't matter. Like they're not standing around for a half an hour listening to me tell jokes. It was like a 1 second joke. So that's all I ever had to do. But then when I was on stage, it was like, fuck, I have these 10 minutes. I got to tell lots of jokes. And so I remember one of my early jokes that was really, really bad was about a purse falling out of my mouth. Something about like how I talk gay purse out of, I don't fucking know, but it was bad. And then just as I got older, I started recognizing that like my strength was just in telling things about my life and explaining things. I learned really quickly that I could explain things in a funny way and like complicated historical things that I really got off telling people and giving people historical context for like why something is the way it is. And my major in school was in history, so I was always like really focused in that.
Why'd you major in history?
Because I just love it. I also think it's like, I think it's how you answer things. I mean, I think like, you know, so often people don't put historical context into the reasons why they think things and or the reason why things are the way they are. Like when we were talking about In-N-Out, like there's a reason why that film came out in 1998 and what was going on at that time and everything. And like people often sort of talk about history as if it were in 2016 and not considering that that thing happened in whatever year it happened and why it happened and what was happening around that moment. Like,
it sounds like you have two tones here that might seem initially like they're in conflict because you say like you like history and you like explaining things and you like understanding the reasons for stuff and also that you worked in politics, which seems very serious. And then you're a comedian. And so those seems like
they would say in politics, I was a fundraiser. So
okay.
if you're going to be a comedian and you're going to like the place within politics where anyone who's artistic or has words and loves words and has to form words and get people to buy whatever they're selling, it's the speechwriter and it's the fundraising department. Mm-hmm. And I was a pretty good fundraiser because I was able to talk to people and I was able to like explain things to them. And then I definitely was there, not on a policy side. I was definitely there on a let's sell a candidate side.
Did you have a point where you decided to focus full time on comedy?
Yeah, I had a day job and I was in New York for years, and then I moved to Los Angeles in 2012, and then I had a job that whole time, and I was still performing and writing and doing stand up and stuff. And then I came to Los Angeles and I got sick, and I went through that year of chemo, and then I decided to just not go back to work. And I was writing more, and I fortunately was getting a lot of sort of freelance jobs writing, and I was getting some more exposure for it, and then the book situation is in the works, so like things were going well, so I decided to just focus on it, and it's so far so good, fingers crossed.
When you made that decision, not going to go back to work, why like what was better about writing than the job you're doing?
Well, I got fired from a lot of day jobs, and I was never an office person ever. And I've never, it goes back to my social anxiety. I'm not a people person without medication. And so it takes a lot for me to, I mean, even like when I'm performing stand-up, I feel very comfortable performing stand-up because it's just me talking to people and that's fine. But it's the communication that happens after the show that is the hardest. So I take that Ativan as soon as I get off stage. So in a weird way, like, it's for the best that I work for myself, or that I work among writers, or I work among like-minded people that understand what it's like to be in your head all the time.
What is it like?
Depressing. I don't know. It's not depressing. I think it's I don't know. I don't know. I was talking to a friend yesterday about, feeling okay with yourself and being fine with being sort of alone and working and sort of trying to create whatever you're trying to create, and purposely isolating yourself from others in order to work on what you want to work on. And I think there's some healthy aspects of that. I think it could get out of hand, of course, but I'm in my head a bunch, and I don't know any other way to be.
Are you funny in your head?
No, I'm really hard on myself. Very hard on myself. I am funny. My cat makes me laugh a lot. That I think at home, like I don't watch a lot of comedy. I don't read a lot of comedy necessarily. Although I do read like essays, like funny humorous essays. But I don't really watch a lot of comedy. I don't like watching comedy. I prefer documentaries, dramas, real stuff. I tend to be more dark at home, and then when I'm out, I tend to be more lively and alive. But
when you said a year where you were undergoing chemo and dealing with being sick, being dark in your head must have been a really difficult default state of mind to have during that time.
Yeah, you'd think that, but it actually was beneficial because there's two ways you can go when you go through chemo. You can either become that fucking hero, warrior, fighting that battle bullshit that I never subscribed to. It just fucking sucked, and it made me angry. And I wanted to be angry, and I also wanted to be upset, and I wanted to be pissed about it. And I didn't want to, wear a ribbon or, join a cause or, march in some walking thing. Like, I didn't want to do any of that shit because it just felt like that was all bullshit. Not to knock down anybody who loves that, but you're fooling yourself. And I wanted to be angry because, you're dealing with life and death. Like, there are people sitting around me that, are dead now. I think it's good to, have people and family and friends and to put things in perspective. And, yes, try to think positively about your outcome and all of that, the power of positive thinking, whatever. But, at the end of the day, I'm a naysaying Jew who's always going to be a little cynical about, why something is the way it is. And so I was just angry, for a long, long time. And then I over time, I've tried to work that anger into my work or my material or my book or whatever. Before cancer, I was kind of wandering around trying to find sort of this, not identity, but this this sort of sense of self that I was looking for in my 20s. And I think in some ways, like, cancer kind of lost that noise, that need to, like, try to find whatever I was looking for in terms of dating, in terms of comedy, in terms of whatever. And it made me kind of realize that everything's bullshit and it's that none of it really matters and everything can change really, really quickly. And then just letting that be the reality. So, like, if that day was an angry day, well, then that's an angry day. Or if that day was a sad day, it's a sad day. Or if it's a happy day, let it be a happy day. Like, it's just sort of, and I still am like that. I still get those moments. Like, earlier this week, I was going to go with a friend somewhere, and I just told him I couldn't because I was having a low day. And that was just sort of, you know, and before cancer, I probably would have been like, ah, I'm busy today, I can't. I would give some sort of excuse. But, you know, being open and honest, but not in a Debbie Downer way, but being open and honest about sort of what you're feeling and thinking and going through, I think is, cancer really helped me with that.
Something you mentioned about Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin is that these are comedians who, like, you describe them as being ugly and not in, like, oh my God, they're hideous kind of way, but that there's an unconventionalness to their look that you might initially think of, you know, for somebody who's going to be on screen, that's a huge disadvantage.
Yeah.
But sometimes people are ugly and sometimes life is ugly and that's just the way it is.
Exactly. I mean, that's what the hand you're dealt.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, like, why it was important to you that those were ugly women that you were connecting with.
I don't know. That's a hard question. I think I definitely, I have a soft spot for the underdog. I think a lot of people do. But I think every minority definitely does. And I think that in some ways, when you're made to feel sort of like left out or isolated or different or just sort of forgotten about, I think a lot of times you tend to gravitate towards people that speak to sort of the empowerment you're looking for in whatever situation you find yourself in. I think they definitely spoke to that. But I also think, like, you know, I prefer a no bullshit aspect to my life. And I tend to block out noise and drama, and I tend to avoid, you know, if I sense something going in a direction of drama, it just seems like such a waste of time, especially considering everything that happened a couple of years ago. And I think there is some strength in ugly, you know, and when I say ugly, I mean just like the non-normally beautiful, normally considered beautiful thing. Like, there's some strength in sort of being the oddball out, because you'll always have a career. And also, just in general, you'll always have a point of view that doesn't mesh with everyone else, and you'll always be uniquely yourself.
You posted on Facebook a couple days ago a photo of yourself wearing, getting ready for Screen Actors Guild, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a very honest photo that you posted.
Oh, what was I doing? I forget.
It was a trio of selfies.
Oh yeah. So there was this compression shirt that someone had given me to wear for the Screen Actors Guild. Because, like, whenever you're going to be on TV or whenever, like, whatever, you want to look your best. Like, you want to do it. So I put on this compression shirt and, like, it sucked. Like, it was not fun. And I'm wearing this compression shirt. I'm taking pictures side by side. And I just, whatever, it was what it was. But then I put on my tux and everything and, like, nothing fit right, and I didn't feel right, and, like, everything was sort of like, what is this body? What's going on here? And then I just lost it. I just took it off. I mean, I like that. I like being able to, like, I mean, I've definitely been thinking, as a gay male, I've been thinking a lot about, like, male body image and sort of what we're fed as a culture, especially a gay culture, what we're fed as the norm of what you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to strive for. I'm definitely guilty of trying to strive for that and the reality of whatever you're dealt. And then just poking fun at it. Like, you know, we've all put on, and especially if you have a little bit of extra body fat on you and you've had to dress up for something, you've probably put on a compression shirt. Like, let's be real. If you're in an urban city and you're surrounded by muscle and you're going to an event where everyone's beautiful, you're going to put on something to make yourself look a little svelte. And then, I mean, I think in some ways, like, even being at that event, like, I recognized being there that, like, one of my strengths was that I never feel like I belong, so I can do whatever I want. And I never feel like I have to, like, conform to whatever they're doing. So I took it off because it was bullshit. I don't know. Let's get naked. Like, why are we so... I went to a Korean spa the other day with two friends, a straight guy and a gay friend of mine. And my straight buddy I go to the Korean spa with all the time, and it's fine. And he's like this tall, like lean dude, but not particularly muscly. He's just like a tall, lean dude. So he's naturally skinny. And then there's me, the sort of like doughy looking Jew, sort of average height guy. And then my gay friend, who's like super muscly. And it was funny. It was interesting because my gay friend was the one that was so self-conscious of his body in that moment. Because he had to be totally naked. And he was so self-conscious of his body. And, you know, here I am, I'm feeling fine. But in comparison to him, I'm like, you know, fucking Melissa McCarthy. But he's the most self-conscious about his body. And that just felt like shit to me. It was sad in a way. It was just sort of, I don't know. I just kept being like, let the D out, dude. Like, just let it out. Like, live your life with your D out. Because if you don't, like, you're just going to, like, not eat things and be boring for the rest of your life. I'm not going to go out of my way to, like, try to be super skinny because it's just not me. I'm a very German person. I have very big legs.
Well, like you said before, that there's a power in being ugly, and ugly can mean a lot of things, whether it's ugly yep. because you feel ugly or you're an outcast or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And just feeling it. Call yourself ugly. Yeah. Love it. Like, I mean, I don't feel ugly, but I definitely feel different, and I kind of love that.
That's why I love the word queer.
Yeah, I do too. I think the word queer is amazing. I think it's powerful. I think it's honest. I think more people should use it.
Well, so if people want to find you online, where can they find some of your stuff? Where can they connect with you?
Well, you can go to hallenscott.com and you can just follow me on Twitter. I mean, stuff's always going there. Every Tuesday we release a podcast for the Golden Girls podcast. And
which is required listening, I should say.
Thank you.
Like, it is such a fantastic show, and I love it. And when you have guests or when you're just talking about the show, because I've seen so many episodes so many times that I'm like, oh, hooray, we get to enjoy these jokes one more time.
I mean, we love the Golden Girls, of course. And Carrie and I and my buddy Elliot Glazer, Elliot and I were going to be the ones to do it, and then he was traveling so much so couldn't do it. And Carrie and I became really close friends, and so we've done it. And it's fun because, like, I was so hesitant of doing a podcast for so long because it felt like everybody was fucking doing a podcast. And then I told myself, like, the only way I would do a podcast is if it had a point. If there was a point to it that I could talk about something that was relevant to my life and that I enjoyed. And then when this Golden Girls thing came up, it was just like, oh, I can definitely talk about that.
Hey, Alan Scott, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to H. Allen Scott for joining me. Definitely subscribe to the show he co-hosts, Out on the Lanai. It is just fantastic. I don't know where to start with recommendations this week because our conversation was all about funny ladies, and there are so many I want you to know about, from contemporary comedians to Broadway singers to Golden Age stars to vaudeville pioneers. So I decided to narrow down my list of possible recommendations to just funny women who have hosted The Muppet Show. And there are still a ton. Candace Bergen, Gilda Radner, Liza Minnelli, Cloris Leachman, Rita Moreno, she won an Emmy for her appearance. But I settled on an episode from season 1, hosted by Phyllis Diller. You can find it online, albeit with Serbian subtitles, just by Googling her name plus Muppet Show. What I love about Phyllis is that she is completely fearless with her comedy, unafraid to look silly or foolish or ugly for the sake of an honest joke. When Rolf tells her that she doesn't know what it's like to live as a dog, she says, "Don't be so sure." And that's how Phyllis's comedy works. She always wanted you to know. She's got it bad. You've got it bad. Everyone's got it bad in some way or another. So we might as well enjoy having it bad together. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone supporting The Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Each episode takes about 10 hours to produce. So if you're enjoying them, please join the fabulous listeners who are keeping the podcast going for as little as $1 an episode. Just visit sewersofparis.com and click on Support the Show on Patreon. You can also leave a review of the show on iTunes for free. Big thanks to Scruffy Rat, who says, "There's a comforting nostalgia to these interviews. My middle school self is giddy from this shared experience. 20 years never too late." Well, I'm glad you and your middle school self are enjoying the show. Me and my middle school self will be right over here hiding from the football team. If you have any thoughts on today's episode, please get in touch. Tweet at me at Matt Baume. You can check out the show notes at sewersofparis.com, and please keep rating and reviewing the show in the iTunes store. Those reviews make a huge difference. Check out my book, Defining Marriage, now out in paperback and audiobook. You can find it at definingmarriage.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant